Rick Mixter with us as we talk about the incredible stories around the Great Lakes. His latest book is called Bottled Goodbyes, Aviation and Maritime Disasters. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie, along with Rick Mixter. Rick, what got you interested in these disasters at the Great Lakes?
Well, I've always been surrounded by the Great Lakes. You know, we have a Great Lake within 3 hours drive anywhere we go. But it was in my career, just like when you covered the Edmund Fitzgerald, that we had the largest tanker explosion, the Jupiter, full of gasoline in September of 1990. Exploded on my beat, and I was the camera guy and ran the live truck and couldn't believe it, walking the melted deck where a sailor had lost his life, and I wanted to learn everything. So I took up scuba diving in 91 and never looked back. Now I've got 30 years of stories and perhaps one of the biggest, I think, archives of magazine articles and podcasts at shipwreckpodcast.com and books and DVDs. It's just amazing to think of what's happened since then.
I'm a certified scuba diver, but I'm not sure I'd like to dive in the Great Lakes.
I would love to take you to one of our shipwrecks. We've got amazing preserves that actually protect the shipwrecks that are down there from theft. And with a good wetsuit, or I love dry suits when we get into especially Lake Superior, you're very comfortable, and it's a very safe sport when you work within the limits of what sport diving limits are. There's certainly some dangers as you go much deeper, and there's people who are well qualified to do that. But I like to keep it at least to 160 feet on my dives and then in a submarine for anything deeper.
That's pretty good. I want to go down in a dive suit with a helmet.
That would be amazing. We can arrange it. I know a lot of quality instructors.
What was that movie with Cuba Gooding?
It was fantastic. I can't remember the name of it. Amazing tribute to an African American diver. It was amazing. And
was it Few Good Men?
I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah, that might have been it.
With De Niro
or Men of Honor. One of those.
Men of Honor. Yeah, fantastic movie.
I love that stuff too. And your book, of course. Where do you get? I said Amazon. Am I right?
I wish. I wish I could do it there. Unfortunately, with shipping, it's tough. But shipwreckpodcast.com or Lake Fury, like a storm, lakefury.com. Or if you just looked up Rick and Shipwreck in Google, you will find me. So that's the best place. Or check your local maritime museum. Ask them, because we love to support those museums and libraries. So the museum would be a great place if there's a gift shop.
Are you a musician, too?
No, I work with a fantastic musician named Dan Hall, and we do concerts, two-hour concerts called Storm, and we bring a lot of the stories of the area in, so we customize it for every location. We've done almost 20 of them, and of course, COVID slowed us down, but the music that Dan does, based on the interviews that I've done, are customized for each of those shipwrecks, and it tells the stories of the 1913 storm, the 1940 storm, so many. You know, if you think about it, this is November 10th today. We actually had 60 ships sink on this date since 1820. We only think about Fitzgerald because of the song, but there's another 160 lives that were lost just on this day alone. So there's so many stories on the November gales that are beyond Fitzgerald.
What's one of the most emotional stories you've come across, Rick?
For me, I covered it in my book, Bottled Goodbyes. It's the Plymouth. It's a schooner that was left in the great storm of 1913. They basically were abandoned because they thought they could make it through the storm. The tugboat that was towing them was sinking. They went off. They came back, and the boat with seven lives was gone. And then a message came in a bottle, a very authentic message, where the guy basically said, I hope I see you in heaven, to his wife and kids. And at the very bottom, he said, by the way, the company owes me $35, so you can get it. A mix of just devastation and then, holy cow, this, you know, the guy's trying to get whatever he can. So the book goes into so many of those stories. I even have three bottles from the Titanic that we talk about as well in there. So there's many amazing stories that are some true, and very many of them are actually, you know, hoaxes. And I don't understand why people would do that, to throw a bottle in the ocean and make it up. But it happened so often that the insurance company, Lloyd's of London, offered a reward to stop people from putting fake bottles out.
And these seamen, they got to be tough guys, aren't they?
They really are. I mean, and many of them are loners. You know, there's certainly people that, you know, don't mind a risk. The money is good, and it's always been pretty good on the Great Lakes. Now, it's a lot safer with 1,000-foot freighters delivering cargo. But it is a different breed of person, and I've been very fortunate to sail on a couple of ships with crews, only as a passenger with a, you know, carrying my camera. But I've made a couple of voyages across Lake Superior, and it was just very interesting to see how they live.
Could we have another Edmund Fitzgerald disaster? Is that conceivable?
Yeah, most people believe it will. I mean, as long as we build ships and they float on the water and we have big storms and people take chances, I think that it could happen. We've been very lucky that we've only lost tugboats and smaller craft since the Fitzgerald went down in 75. That's still the largest on the Great Lakes. And we've had big accidents where the big 1,000-foot freighters have run aground. But thank heavens, you know, that they were saved and the people were brought out and rescued, or they just waited till they were towed off. So we've seen minor incidents, but with better weather forecasting, with suits that you can wear now for immersion, you know, if you have to go into the water, and even lifeboats you can crawl into and slide off the ship, the technology is a lot better. Even EPIRBs that feed satellites, you know, to tell you where you are if you do go into the water. There's a lot of better life-saving things that they have that just weren't even thought of in the 1960s into the 1970s when the Fitz went down.
And you said you were from the Upper Peninsula. You eventually went up there?
Yeah, in fact, I was born up at the air base. That's why I think I'm so interested in airplanes, because I smelt the B-52 JP-4 fuel when I was born. So I've always been enthralled by the history of Michigan, and it's taken me to every corner of the state, to the bottom of the Sioux Locks and all over. So I just love the Great Lakes and the history that surrounds it, and I'll just continue telling those stories till I can't anymore.
Folks from Wisconsin think they should have the Upper Peninsula. It's attached to them.
We worked it out that they could have Toledo in Ohio, so we got the Upper Peninsula for ourselves, and it is truly God's country. It's beautiful, and I could see why people would fight for it. But now that we have the bridge and an easier way to get up there, I think we'll keep it.
How old were you when the Fitzgerald went down?
I hesitate to say I was only 8 years old, and it wasn't the worst storm I remember, because the blizzard of 78 buried our trailer. So all of us dug out of 3 years later was a bigger storm that I remember vividly, but I don't remember much about the Fitzgerald storm.
I was in St. Louis during 78, and I remember that blizzard, too. That was huge.
It was crazy. It
wiped out the entire Midwest.
Just amazing. And to think that they get that snow all the time up there is incredible.
Let's go to the phones. Joe in the Bronx to get us started. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
Okay.
Good, good. Yeah, Rick, I wanted to ask you, based on your knowledge of lighthouses, are there any haunted lighthouses? And also, I don't know if you cover, like, necessarily, like, you know, international shipwrecks or whatever, but the Andrea Dora, did they ever recover anything from that ship?
Oh, quite a bit came up, and sadly, many of the divers have been killed trying to get things off the Andrea Doria.
It's
it's deep and it's dangerous, and sadly, we've lost a lot of divers on that. And as far as haunted lighthouses, everybody would have a ghost story. I've heard from, you know, there's at least 5 books out on it. The big ones being Waugashance Lighthouse. There was a big explosion that took a crewman. I actually interviewed a guy that survived it on Standard Rock, and there's talk about ghosts there. There's talk about mystery beacons. Just if you type in haunted and lighthouse on the Great Lakes, I bet you'll find 50 of them. Sechua Light up in the UP is another one that they are convinced there's ghosts in there. I have not personally seen anything mysterious, and I've stayed in many of these lighthouses, but that's probably only a matter of time.
Next up, we go to Jesus in Guate, California. Hi, Jesus.
Hello, this is Jesus. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, we can.
Okay, so my comment and the question is, the comment is that I've been in 2 situations on the, not the Great Lakes, but bodies of water, Crescent City in California, Oregon, and Bahia, Los Angeles, down on the Baja. And both times, it was just like the saying, red skies at night, fisherman's delight, red skies in the morning, fishermen take warning. And both of them happened. And I would never feel so humble to be on a 40-foot fishing boat just with huge swells in Crescent City. And then down at Bahia, Los Angeles, coming back against the south wind, which is horrendous, and think on an 18-footer and think I was going to die with my dad, you know, because we couldn't make it back to the shore. And so both were humble, so humbling, I can't believe it. And then my question is that, Rick, did you ever experience anything like that? Because, you know, I hear the stories of the Great Lakes, you know, I figured I was kind of in it, even though it was the ocean.
Absolutely. Jesus, we were out looking for a shipwreck, and it was foggy and dead calm. And then as we came back, we actually hung the ROV up, the robot that was down 600 feet. So it took us a while to get off the lake. And by the time we came back, there were 8-footers. So we were rolling, I mean, very crazily through. I also was on board the Laurentian, which is a research vessel for University of Michigan. And I was hitting my head from my bunk as we were coming home.
Oh, geez.
So big storms, but I always felt like we were safe on those. I never felt like we were going to be lost. You've got high confidence in your captain, and we certainly came through.
Did you ever have a situation out there, Rick, where you got scared?
Absolutely. I mean, when the lakes get big and you get very concerned, and then when you're diving, there's been times where, you know, I pushed my air a little bit far where I shouldn't have. Anytime I get into my safety margin, I get scared. It's also because when you go past 100 feet, you get nitrogen narcosis.
That's
which
right.
Means you get paranoid and you start to get really scared when you're underwater of ridiculous things like sea monsters and stuff. And it's just because the nitrogen is poisoning your brain, and the deeper you go, the more problem you have. At 165 feet, I can't control my eyes anymore, and it feels like I drank a six-pack of beer. So it's a bad place to be. That's why a lot of these Trimix divers use helium to help them go deeper, and I just believe it's a better, safer way to do it in a submarine.
Be just my luck to have a shark in fresh water.
Yeah. We've got enough stories of those off of Chicago where bull sharks somehow made it up there, but I've never seen an actual true story.
You got to go hunting for the Loch Ness Monster. I bet you could find that thing.
I would love it. And we've got, you know, not only Champ and Lake Champlain, but Lake Erie has all kinds of stories of serpents that are there and very, you know, described right down to the T on hairy monsters and stuff that are in the water. It's amazing. There's a lot of those stories as you're looking for shipwreck stories, too.
Did you ever go to Belle Isle?
Absolutely. The pilot house of the William Clay Ford is there. That was a ship that looked for Fitzgerald. It's a fantastic, you know, representation of the type of ship that the Fitz was. In fact, it was launched just before the Fitzgerald at the same shipyard. Belle Isle's museum at Dawson is a fantastic representation of the incredible museums we have all around the Great Lakes that represent the maritime, you know, community.
Let's go to Jonathan in Toledo, Ohio. First-time caller. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi, I was calling. I could probably talk for hours with you. My uncle was a tugboat captain, and he would tell us stories on that. That's why he became a tugboat, because he was on those ships. But the last time I was 14, and it was 1975, and I believe it was in October. Was that the last time the Evan Fitzgerald was in Toledo? Because we would go fishing, and across the docks, I remember seeing that ship with the big letters. And then there's another ship we have here. It's a floating museum called the SS Boyer, and they have a museum, and you can go in there. The beautiful woodwork in this ship, and I don't know if it was in the 20s or 30s, but it's massive. They take you down into the cargo holds, and this was not a super tanker. It's massive, and it makes you really wonder, like, wow, I'm just an ant compared to what they can hold.
The Edmund went to Toledo a lot, didn't it, Rick?
It really did, and the Boyer is now repainted as its original name, the Schoonmaker. I was just on board her not even 2 weeks ago, and she survived the 1913 storm. But the Fitz was in that harbor at least a dozen times that season, so no surprise that you saw it. It was making a different run as it was coming on that last run just into the Detroit River to unload at Zug. But, yeah, it's no surprise you saw it in Toledo, because that was her nickname, Toledo Express.
Thomas in La Jolla, California. Hello, Tom.
Hi, George. Thank you. And Rick, this interview is great. You are so enthusiastic. And I wanted to ask, you know, I've always wondered all of my life how were the Great Lakes formed? I mean, it's so mysterious to me. They're fresh water, yet they have all of these bottlenecks, you know, like between North and South Michigan, Detroit and Windsor, Niagara Falls, and they don't really connect directly to the Atlantic Ocean. I never really bought the glacier theory, you know, carving out the Great Lakes. And so I was wondering if geologically, how were they formed? And thank you again for this interview.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm glad to talk to you. Certainly the glaciers played a part in it. We can tell that by, you know, much of the scouring that we see in the rocks. But, you know, you're talking about, at one time, volcanic activity, especially on Lake Superior. We can tell where those the whole shelf collapsed in, and the rocks are actually facing in a certain way. So we know that volcanic activity did part of it. It used to be a saltwater sea, so we have huge amounts of limestone, too. That's where you get the limestone deposits where the Niagara Falls are, where the water cascades down. But certainly the glaciers, I mean, you're talking about a two-mile thick, you know, ice that crushed its way through and ground out the general shapes of what we had that used to be just river systems that became the Great Lakes. So I think they're still figuring out a lot of it, but there's a good lock on exactly how they were formed and some things that make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I think, Rick, the glacier theory is probably the best right now, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, just looking at the rocks, if you go into any footage from NASA of the Great Lakes, you can see the striation in the rocks where they ground their way through. There's no question that, you know, it played a major part.
Absolutely. Rick Mixter with us. Your websites, Rick, would you just yell them out for us?
Sure. Shipwreckpodcast.com or lakefury.com. You find all the shipwreck stuff you want and at least 14 hours of podcasts on there for free.
We're going to take your calls throughout the rest of this hour here on Coast to Coast as we're talking about the disasters in the Great Lakes. And you say you go back when? How far back? Rick? Where is Rick?
In 1679 to explore further.
I mean, the Indians, of course, called Superior what? Lake Gitche-Gumee?
Gitche-Gumee, yep, and all of the islands were magical to them because, you know, they believed that the spirits were in those areas, and so much of that area is considered holy ground to the Native Americans.
It's truly remarkable. Yeah, in just so many deaths, 25,000 dead people missing?
It's incredible. I mean, you think of the average freighter would have, you know, 30 people on board, or the schooner would have 6 people on board. It's, you know, no surprise that many of these ships just simply vanished. But with the big storms, especially, you know, as you go into the late 1800s, into the 1900s, 1913, where 12 ships disappeared, you know, these big storms was where they really got cast ashore in large numbers. And Chicago's big storm brought the Michigan. I actually cover the story in my book, Bottle Goodbyes. And that boat was actually just now found on one of the expeditions I was up on Lake Superior. So a big, huge schooner that was just discovered this year that was lost in 1901.
Was there an insurance settlement for those Edmund Fitzgerald folks?
There was. It started out at $8 million, and that was part of the liability problem. You know, the shipping company wanted to prove that it wasn't their fault. It wasn't the old ship or, you know, the damaged ship. Mm-hmm. They wanted to blame McSorley for running it aground, and that's part of the reason we see those theories.
And it was owned by an insurance company, right?
It was. Chartered by Columbia Transportation, but owned by Northwest Mutual.
That's strange. Okay, we're going to come back in a moment with Rick Mixter and take final calls next on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, the great debate between Howard Bloom and John Curtis in our first segment, so get ready for that, and then we're going to talk about Alaska's mysterious triangle on Coast to Coast. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie here along with Rick Mixter. Rick, are there many survivors of these disasters, like in the Edmund Fitzgerald, 29 people, all of them died? What about survivors on some of the other type of mishaps?
Many survivors, unfortunately, we're losing them by the minute. In fact, the Cedarville that was lost by the Mackinac Bridge, the largest intact shipwreck in Lake Huron, just lost their cook just 2 weeks ago. So I've been lucky to capture the really the stories of the largest shipwreck in Lake Erie. I've got an eyewitness from that when the Reed went down. I've got the guy that survived on the sole survivor of the Daniel J. Morrell, Dennis Hale, who's now passed. Two guys survived when the Bradley went down in 1958. A Coast Guard cutter called the Sundew raced out to get them, and I not only interviewed the captain on the Sundew, but the corpsman who pulled the guys out of the water and the survivor, Frank Mays, who made it through. So it's been great to get all of those different angles and to also travel on icebreakers and you know, do these stories around the Great Lakes that have affected so many lives for hundreds, you know, literally hundreds of years now.
What other projects are you working on?
I'm thinking now of a book on Fitzgerald. I have so much stuff. I've got a best-selling documentary that's been aired on PBS, and I think it's time to do something with that. I would very much like to do something with a lot of my crazy adventures of flying and diving that haven't been covered yet. There's so many different projects as I look at, you know, what I'm going to do this winter. We are filming all summer for a new version of Final Run, which covers the big storms and uses a lot of my interviews with updates on all the shipwrecks that have been discovered. And as soon as I make a video, they find the shipwreck that I say hasn't been found yet, so I have to fix it.
Find D.B. Cooper.
That would be amazing, and there's actual researchers in Michigan, Ross Richardson, that has information on that. I think that it's intrigued people forever, and I think that would be an amazing, amazing discovery.
Back to the calls, Joe in Monterey, California. Joseph, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Thank you, Joe. Go ahead.
I was in the Navy, and I was on the Josephus Daniels. We have a 26 sonar, the latest sonar. I don't know what kind of sonar was used in searching. I know they have a magnetic air detection. The military has that to find large metal objects like submarines under the water. Do you remember the Scorpion that went down in
1968? Yes. Yep.
Our ship went out there. We went out there and with a flotilla. My ship is a DLG or it's a cruiser, light cruiser, and we had 50-foot swells.
Wow.
in off of Cape Hatteras looking for the Scorpion. I don't know the weather conditions that you were searching in. It can be pretty rough, but sonar could work in most any kind of weather. How long was the search going on, do you recall?
And what Fitzgerald gear did they use? They used a P-3 Orion that's normally used to find 500-foot-long, you know, Soviet submarines. So imagine these guys fly over. They have a 700-foot freighter with 26,000 tons of iron ore pellets. That magnometer, it just panged on it. It was the biggest target they'd ever seen. So they found it immediately, and then the Coast Guard promptly lost the buoy that they placed in a storm. So they had to come back from Glenview, Illinois. And I cover all this in my podcast on the Fitzgerald with the actual people who are on board the airplane. Believe it or not, we have a Scorpion in Lake Superior as well, an F-89 ship that was actually chasing an unidentified flying object and vanished. And I actually found an F-89 in the woods in the UP near the Air Force Base. We'd always heard about it, and we found the tail and everything section that was in the woods. So a lot of stories that are attached to aviation and our own Scorpion in that way.
Before you were born, the Thresher, do you ever remember doing work on that? The submarine that went down?
I know the connection with the Scorpion and the Thresher, but I haven't done a lot of research on them. But there's certainly ties to Titanic as they were doing some research on the submarine and trying to find them.
We lost 129 crew people on that one. Jeez,
wow.
Horrible. Joe, Long Island, New York. Go ahead, Joseph.
Hey. Congratulations on the book. I have three things I want to bring up. First would be, does the lake or did the lake use beacons to measure the waves as an alert? Because I know in Indonesia when they had those tidal waves or walls of water, they said they did not have a beacon that would have alerted the people on the beaches that this earthquake-generated tsunami was on its way, and that might have given people a chance to escape. So that'd be the first thing. The second thing would be, as far as the ship itself, how would you look at it? Could it seemed to perform from 57 to 75. So was it weakened, or was it in a slightly in a state of disrepair or old as compared to the Titanic, which was on a native voyage? And then lastly, on the museum, does the museum cite Indian history or that far-fetched or possibility of the Egyptians having been to the Great Lakes, ancient Egyptians, or more likely the Vikings? Also, Rick, did you fly B-52s?
I was lucky enough to be a passenger. In fact, they wrote in grease pencil on the side, "One wannabe," and you know who they were talking about. That was me. We flew not only the last missions out of Michigan, but also flew a global power mission to Germany and dropped a fake bomb on the Netherlands. But in answer to your question, yeah, the Vikings, there is some evidence that they had made it to the Great Lakes. There's always been some artifacts that have been tied to it that, you know, have not been confirmed. As far as the buoys go, yes, we've got buoys that real-time monitor the wave heights, the wind direction, and we didn't have that, unfortunately, during the Fitzgerald, but today we do, and it's amazing to see the data that comes out of that. And the structural problems with the Fitzgerald were well logged. In fact, the Coast Guard looked into it. In my podcast, I go into very long interviews with the cook, who was the guy who wintered on the ship, who talked about the keel being loose, that they went inside when they put bow thrusters in the front of the ship, that they realized that the keel had worked its way loose. This was all authenticated by the Coast Guard, and they thought they fixed it. But the way that ship flexed in storms, and the fact that McSorley, the final captain, pushed the heck out of that ship. He came through more storms than any other captain, according to the Coast Guard investigators. And that just broke the ship. It was pushed beyond its ability. And only one of the sisters is still floating. The Jackson is still out there. And so we don't believe it was a design problem, although there is some issues with the way they pump out the water that gets into the cargo hold. But that's been resolved, I think, on future designs.
Was it a doomed ship from the get-go, Rick, or could they have pulled out of it?
I think they could have. I mean, obviously, you don't push a ship to go that much. And if it was swinging, you know, and it had all those structural issues, there's talk that McSorley understood hulls a lot better than most captains would. I mean, he actually was doing inspections during part of his career. Maybe he trusted it more than he should have. I don't think it was doomed from the beginning. I mean, clearly the Jackson is still sailing, and that was only 2 years, you know, younger than the Fitzgerald. It's had a long career. It's just, unfortunately, you know, some of these get pushed beyond what they could be, and if that's captain bravado or, you know, monetary, I get mad when I hear shipping companies being blamed, because not since the 1913 storm has there been bonuses paid to captains for taking chances. Now it's really up to the skippers and whether or not they park the ship. And nobody wants to lose men. Nobody wants to lose cargo or ships. It's too expensive. So to blame it on the shipping company is a little silly.
Take final calls. David in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
How you doing, George?
Great.
I want to bring up, I had a relative on the PT-109. I know this had nothing about the Great Lakes, but I heard my grandma used to tell me that when the Japanese destroyer went through that, and of course our President Kennedy was
he was on that, yeah.
At lieutenant, yes, on that, and my relative was one of the machine gunners, and he told the stories how they had to survive after the Japanese went through, swimming through the oil and everything. And you talk about one of the disasters of the South Pacific, how the whole crew survived that has always been amazing. And all of them received the Navy Cross. And also, I want to bring up one more thing before I hang up. He was talking about Lake Erie. I have a little bit of Native American in me, and the Erie Indians used to talk about the giant serpent of Lake Erie. And I'll hang up and just hear what the comments are.
All right. Go ahead, Rick.
They actually named, I believe, their hockey team after the lake monster of Lake Erie. So there's been lots of sightings of that, and it certainly does go back to Native American tales that come through. And many of the manitous or the spirits that are on the lakes have been blamed, you know, for many of the, you know, the accidents that have happened. Even up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, it's called Death's Door by the Native Americans, translated into French as Porte de Mort. So the Native American legends obviously are very big in the folklore, especially of our Great Lakes, and stories that are just as awesome to tell.
Eric, truck driving in Indiana. Hello, Eric. Go ahead.
Hello, George. Long time no talk to you.
Thank you, sir. Hope you're well.
Yes, sir, I am. I'm doing good. You got a great guest on tonight. I really love this kind of stuff here. I do have a question for him, though. Have you ever talked to any of the family members of the Fitzgerald?
Absolutely, Eric. It's been difficult because we did find a missing crewman, and that put it at odds with at least two of the families were very, very upset. I've interviewed one. She just recently passed away. She was from my hometown of Gwynn, and to hear the stories of her losing her dad, it's just heart-wrenching. And you know, Ruth Hudson lost her son. I've talked to the brothers of the second engineer, the third engineer. We constantly run into relatives of the mates that were on board, and many of those talks are good ones, and they've watched my programs. They understand the documentaries that I put together. Some were very upset in the first documentary that I did that had a very far away shot of a missing crewman, and I totally understand that. So there's, you know, I'm definitely at odds with some too that don't want that part to come out. And there are many that want to keep the wreck sealed off. The Canadian government has a permit process to go out there, and right now you need a permit to go. It's not off limits. It just needs a permit to go, and no one's going to get a permit unless perhaps you're Bob Ballard, who found Titanic, or Jean-Michel Cousteau or something. I think they'd have no problem, but I don't know if Rick will be able to go back anytime soon, but I've got a lot of questions after 30 years of researching it that I'd like to answer, and the only way to do that is to go back.
Carl is with us in Charlotte, North Carolina. We'll get you in here. Carl, go ahead.
Hey, I'm glad I made it through, buddy, so I won't talk. I know I don't have much time left. My brother goes fishing up there, Lake Erie. I grew up in Youngstown, actually, about an hour from Cleveland, what they call, rightfully, the mistake on the lake. That's one on my bucket list, to go walleye fishing one more time. But that lake can kick up in a hurry, and that lake is a bad lake. What he says, Superior, or he says further below, Lake Ontario takes in what Lake Erie can send her. But I was reading about the Carl Bradley real quickly. It said there's like a long decompression time after going down that deep. How long do you have to decompress after something like that?
Oh, many of my friends went down there. In fact, they actually brought the bell up from the Carl Bradley. John Jansen and John Scholes went down and brought it up. They had several hours of decompression. I was lucky. We had a submarine, so the depths were pretty easy. My job was to film the submarine from the water side, so I jumped in the water when survivor Frank Mays went into the submarine, and that was my job, was just to film the sub, and I didn't have to go too deep and decompress. It can get really cold when you're just hanging on a line waiting for your body to get, you know, used to the pressure.
Rick, I assume there have been a lot of prayers for those 29 souls.
There isn't, for everybody lost on the Great Lakes, 25,000 prayers, you know, for each of those people that have been lost, especially during November gales. We remember them today.
The Mariners Church was very busy during that time period, wasn't it?
It really was, and today, you know, all the bells are going to be rung, and Mariners Church and Whitefish Point all will have big, you know, memorials for the crews that were lost, where they'll read the names, and it's a very sobering time. I try to avoid that as much as I can, because it's too much to think about. You know, if you're going to do investigations, you can't worry too much about, you know, the people that were there. You respect them. You know that it's a graveyard, but it's still, you know, part of the investigation, and that's the way I have to look at it. If I thought of every, you know, body I covered as a journalist, it would just devastate me. So you try not to.
Absolutely. Rick, thanks for being on the program. Keep in touch with us. We'll try to get you on our Beyond Belief show. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasore, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.